Hi, I'm Matthew Kelly, and welcome to Profoundly Human. About once a year, I walk into a room with the leaders of various organizations that I lead, that I own, that I've founded, and I say to those leaders, you have got to read this book. It happens about once a year, and last year it was this book. The book is called Wanting. The author is Luke Burgess. He's with me today. It is an absolutely phenomenal book. It will blow your mind in every aspect of your life. You pick any aspect of your life and read it. Read this book through the lens of that aspect of your life, and it will change the way you think about that aspect of your life. Luke, welcome. Honored to have you.
Matthew, thanks for the very kind words. It's an honor to be here. And I remember reading Rediscover Catholicism in 2008, and that was that book for me that year.
Wow, I appreciate that. So wanting, we want all the time, and we think a lot about what we want, but what is very clear from the book is that we know so very little about why we want what we want. I guess the first question I have for you is, in its simplest form, why do we want what we want?
According to the thinker that changed my life, René Girard, who inspired my book, we want things due to a social process because we're social creatures. You know, we're not these independent, completely autonomous beings that we often like to think we are, where we generate our desires out of nothing, you know. We're profoundly dependent, dependent on God, of course, and dependent on other people for even our very desires, even the things that we want. And Girard's key insight into human nature and human behavior is that human desire is fundamentally imitative, or mimetic. Mimetic is a bit of a fancier word to refer to a specific kind of imitation, and I'm sure we'll get into that later. So that our desires are formed through other people who act as models of desire for us. And this was a profound insight for me. You know, normally we think of imitation on a surface level. We think of imitating languages and customs and dress and things like this. We don't often think that human imitation goes down to the profound level of desire, so that the people that I'm around are actually influencing what I want, which means it's really important, far more important than we even realize, to be around people that want the things that we want, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and the things that are really worth wanting, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But most people, I think at first blush, would find a concept somewhere on the spectrum of offensive, from mildly offensive to very offensive, because we think our desires are so unique. We think our desires is one of the forums where we express real independence. Do you come up against that when you're having conversations with people? Do people push back on what you've just said and said, no, I mean, I'm a fiercely independent person. I want what I want because I want it, and it is not influenced by all these other things?
Oh, there's massive psychological blocks up to this concept. I mean, I encounter fierce resistance, even in myself. You know, that was my first reaction when I discovered this idea, from René Girard, who's a very serious, devout Catholic, by the way, was resistance. And there's a certain level of, I think, humility required, first of all, to sort of understand that, you know, from the time I was a baby, you know, I was completely reliant on my parents, and, you know, so totally dependent, and assimilating things I didn't even realize, you know, unconsciously, about what's worthy of, you know, looking at and pursuit. And but there's a funny thing, as children are open imitators, and they're often proud to imitate. You know, they're not ashamed of their imitation. You know, they'll imitate mom or dad and look what I can do, and do the same thing. But something very strange happens as we grow up. You know, usually around the time of adolescence, we sort of enter this world where imitation becomes a bad thing. becomes associated with some loss of our autonomy or something like that. And that's where imitation turns into mimesis, and mimesis sort of connoting a hidden form of imitation where we're constantly trying to hide our own reliance on other people and dependence on other people, even our dependence on God, and try to assert our own autonomy and think of our desires as entirely generated by myself. Like, nobody in the history of the world has ever wanted the same thing that Luke Burgess wants, you know? And it's sort of this flattering of self-sufficiency. And this idea does not mean that our desires are not unique to us. It just means that they go through a process of formation that is social. And I can come out of that process due to my concrete circumstances, my family, the city I live in, all different kinds of things mean that my desires manifest themselves in very specific ways that are very unique to me. But that doesn't mean that they're not formed through this social process. So it's a bit of a both and, right? Where we can come to want a relationship that is very specific to us, right? I mean, desire, even my relationship with God, right? It's a very personal one. But there's also a lot in there that comes through decades. I mean, if we step back and think of, the church, hundreds and thousands of years of formation of desire that's happened, that helps point the way, to what is worthy to want, all the saints. So, we could go on and on about this, right? And I somehow enter into the stream of desire as a person, right? As an individual. And it's a bit of both and. I'm highly formed by it, and I somehow have to make it my own at the same time.
Mm. You talked about the psychological aspect of the concept. Is it a psychological concept? It's impacting history, it's impacting economics, impacting what we buy for lunch and who we're romantically attracted to potentially. Do you think of it first as a psychological concept, or do you think of it in some other way?
I think of it as fundamentally a spiritual concept. I think of desire as something profoundly spiritual and mysterious. And there are three layers and levels to which people think of this idea of mimetic desire. The first is a purely material level. We have mirror neurons in our brains, actually, where if we see somebody else doing something like eating an ice cream cone, we literally have neurons firing in our brain as if we were eating an ice cream cone. They're called mirror neurons. And that provides some kind of a physical basis for this power of imitation that we have. There's a psychological aspect to this, where this is, just psychology. But psychology is a funny thing. Psychology kind of bleeds into the spiritual, right? And I often sometimes wonder if when we're talking about psychology, we're often talking about the spiritual, right? Maybe even theology. So for me, desire is something profoundly spiritual, kind of rooted in St. Augustine's, "Our hearts are restless until they rest in you." And he's talking about desire, right? This is the deepest desires of our hearts. And that's why, this whole idea is very Augustinian in that sense. Like, our desires are infinite, and they're always looking for something to rest in, and they can go off in a million different directions on the horizontal plane, right? Can always find something to satisfy our desires and consumerism, all different kinds of things. But ultimately, our desires are, what are they pointing us towards? And that's where there's a deeply, there's a lot of spiritual theology, I think, that's left unexplored in René Girard. Because for me, the reason this was such an important thing for me to learn is because it profoundly changed my spiritual life.
Mm. So it's interesting, your references to spirituality, your references to Catholicism, yours, Girard's, mine. But the book is really, it's a secular book. Mm-hmm. And the concept is being used by the biggest businesses, brands, and really anyone who wants to affect people's ideology around the world. How do they reconcile what you're talking about with the fact that they're so allergic to religion or spirituality, or do they just implement it without really understanding its full depth and impact on the human person?
I think they bracket out the more profound spiritual implications of it and implement it on a bit more of a surface level, but in very powerful ways. I had a local political leader come to me and recognized and was sort of looking for help. You know, he'd read the book and he said, you know, I think that if I want to affect change in my local community and change the way that people think about this issue, he goes, I think I need to find the right model of desire in the community, and that model of desire will begin to shape what other people want. So he realized that at that level,
yes,
really on a powerful psychological level. And as far as I know, he was able to identify some key models of desire in the community that were inside of it that other people respected. And it was highly effective. So yeah, people are using it to understand everything from, you know, the stock market to why there are these, you know, very powerful kind of herd-like movements up, both up and down, and trends and fashions. And I think that's fine, because it has explanatory power in this kind of secular sense. But there is a deeper spiritual sense, which you obviously saw, and because you read between the lines in the book, that I think some people just aren't quite ready to grasp yet or confront. Mm.
The subtitle for the book is The Power of Mimetic Desire in Everyday Life. For someone who's never heard of it, what is a simple definition? What is mimetic desire for the person who's never heard about it?
It is learning to want something because somebody else wants it. And this usually happens in a very subconscious way. So let me give you a couple of concrete examples to illustrate how this happens from different Perfect. Phases of life. One, this would be familiar to, I think, many listeners. If you turn, you know, a handful of toddlers loose in a room full of abundant toys, more than enough toys for all of them, it usually happens very often that one toy, somebody will pick up one toy, you know, a bright red fire truck, and become fascinated with it. And pretty soon a second child comes over and he's fascinated with it, and then a third, and they reinforce each other's desire for the same toy. Pretty soon all of them will have converged on the same toy and probably start fighting over it or something like that. It's mine, and completely forget about all of the other toys in the room. So it's because of that first child who could have picked it up for any reason. You know, maybe their dad's a firefighter, you know, they had to have some, you know, maybe it was random, but if they are fascinated enough with it, it will draw the second child in, and then it's even easier to draw the third child in, and then even easier for the fourth and the fifth, right? This is mimetic behavior. There's the imitation of desire from the first to the second to the third to the fourth. Why was the U.S. so fascinated with the moon in the 1960s? You know, it's just dusty sphere. You know, there's nothing on it. Because another country became fascinated with it, and it became an object of rivalry. Who can get to the moon first? This happens in relationships very often, where, you know, you'll have. This has happened to me before. In dating somebody in a relationship, and you know, decide, you know, maybe this isn't working so well, and get out of the relationship. And then the very second that there's another model in the picture, let's say, you know, the girl that I was dating all of a sudden has a new boyfriend, and all of a sudden I see that, and it completely changes my desire, because now there's a model of desire back in the picture, and it can take us on these roller coasters. So models of desire really affect us on the level of desire, and we think of our desires as spontaneous while not realizing or admitting the role that models play on us, right? Mm-hmm. And this You know, obviously this happens in work environments all the time. I worked on Wall Street as an investment banker in finance, and it wasn't until I saw one of my good friends leave to go start a company in California that all of a sudden I was inflamed with a desire to do the same thing. And all of a sudden I had the courage to do it. I had a model. So, you know, this plays out in life, how, you know, students choose college majors. The first thing they do is they look around and they ask, well, what do other people want to major in? So we're very social in that way. And those are just a few examples. We could go on and on, because this is something that really happens to us pretty much on a daily basis. You know, my wife and I can't even go eat at a restaurant without me needing to know what she wants on the menu first before I have any idea what I want. I'm sort of overwhelmed. She's my model of desire when it comes to what I typically order. She's also very good with food. So, you know, there's trivial examples, but there are also very serious examples that can determine the path of our entire lives in terms of, you know, what we dedicate ourselves to, the kind of, you know, careers that we pursue, the very shape of our spiritual life, depending on the models of desire that we have.
So walk us to, hey, I'm going to write a book on this. Like, when did you decide I'm going to write a book on this? When did you decide, you know, there isn't enough people out there who have a working knowledge of mimetic desire, and I'm going to popularize this concept, which has been around for a while. I mean, Girard's work is well known academically, mm-hmm. And even functionally in marketing and areas like that. But when mm-hmm. did you decide, hey, I'm going to popularize this concept?
Yeah, Girard wrote his first book in the late 1950s. It's published in English in 1961. So he's been out for a very long time, very popular. I learned about Girard's work around 2010. And I read everything that I could get my hands on because I realized how powerful of a concept this was. In 2017 and 2018, I wanted to learn as much as I possibly could, so I attended an annual conference on René Girard's thought. It was in Denver, and I went there, and it was a highly academic conference. I mean, and this has been going on for a very long time, I think 20 years or so. There's this annual meeting, and I went there with my, you know, I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I've started several companies. I went in there with my entrepreneur hat on, and realizing all of the very practical ways that understanding this theory has played out in my life from a marketing standpoint, from all the relationships. And it was a very nice conference. There were a bunch of papers read. They were very abstract and they were very academic. And I walked out of that conference in Denver thinking to myself, oh no, like, I think I might have to write a book. Because I sit at this very strange intersection of understanding the theory pretty well, having studied it at that point for 7 years or so, having had philosophical and theological formation because I spent time in the seminary, whole another part of my story, and having had this business background, I thought, you know, somebody once gave me the advice that maybe the best book for a person to write is the book that maybe only they could write, or something like that. And I had that realization. It was like a sinking feeling, because I was like, I don't know if I can write a book. Like, well, let me see what's involved. And I went through a process of discernment. It took me about a year and a half to admit that it's what I actually wanted to do, but it was a craving. It was like, I had to give birth to this thing. And if I didn't start to articulate my thoughts, I was just going to go totally crazy. So I set out to do it.
How has the, my experience has been that books have a life of their own, that you can plan to write a certain book, and by the end, you've written a completely different book. You can release a book thinking that the target market is going to be X, and it gets picked up by a completely different market and becomes phenomenally successful in a way that you never imagined. How has the experience of writing the book, releasing the book, surprised you?
Wow, it has been a wild ride, and that's been my experience. It's taken on a life of its own. I wrote it for the broadest possible audience. That was very important for me. I could have written this book for a much more specific niche audience, but I really just wanted to make it an introduction to these powerful ideas because no book was really a good introduction. I was really struggling to recommend. Rene Girard is not easy to read. And I said, you know, this book, I just want to be an introduction and I want people to apply it however they want to apply it. If they want to apply it in a business context, in a psychological context, fine. They want to apply it to their spiritual lives, they can do that. What's a book that I can write that will just resonate with the widest number of people? The timing was very good because this book came out in the summer of 2021 at the peak of the crypto bubble. The peak of all kinds of mimetic things happening in the country. We had the pandemic, we had the stock market going crazy. It seemed like a very mimetic time. And the book came out in the summer of 2021 and it got picked up very strongly by the investing finance business community because it was helping them make sense of what was going on in the world. Including all kinds of scapegoating things that were happening in the political world. So it got picked up and I ran with that and then that was probably the first 6 to 9 months of the book. And then other people started to realize, well, there's actually a lot more here. there's a whole aspect of this that applies to relationships and to the spiritual life. I talked to Bishop Barron about the book. So my editor told me, he goes, you know, Luke, a lot of books these days, they come out of the gate and, you know, they've got 2 or 3 months, kind of like a movie. And, you know, it either sells or it doesn't. And then everybody forgets about it and moves on. This book is a total opposite. I don't know if it's because many people have told me they have to read it more than once. I don't know if that's a compliment or not. But I think it's like a slow burn. And I think there's more and more that kind of sinks in, which is why here I am, you know, almost 2 years later. Having a conversation with you that's unpacking new things in it and in Girard's insights that I probably never talked about in the last 2 years. And that's kind of the beauty of it. It's a very rich theory. So the book is evolving. That life of the book is evolving, reaching new people. And that's been extraordinarily satisfying.
That's fantastic. I wouldn't say you have to read the book more than once. I wanted to read the book more than once. I read the book at least twice. I've read certain parts of it 3, 4, 5 times. I find myself coming back to parts of it and saying, oh, I want to read that again. And I want to read it again around something that is happening in my life or is happening in one of the organizations I'm involved with. But I think the thing that, for me, I come away from the book, the desire I come away from the book with, the wanting that I come away from the book with is wanting to learn how to want well. I know it's a massive question, but how do we learn to want well?
I think the first step is realizing that wanting is something that we have to learn to do well. I mean, just that awareness is not the way that many people think of wanting, right? It's like, I wasn't born just knowing how to think very well, you know, to think in a logical fashion. You know, I had to learn, I had many good teachers, and it's helped me to be a better thinker, at least. And desire is not that much different. We all undergo an education of desire. And that education can be disrupted by various things, right? We can have an education in desire where we learn certain virtues, for instance. And, you know, in order to acquire a virtue, you kind of have to want the virtue, like patience or whatever it is, or fortitude. And that's usually the first step in acquiring it. You find a good model, somebody that has it, you learn from them, you spend time around them. And that's that process of growing in that desire for those things that make a good life is an education in desire. And that education can go totally haywire. You know, I can get on social media and now I've got a billion teachers of desire, people modeling desires to me all over the world. And that can really be a distraction for me. Or interfere in that process of learning to want well. So it's, and there's no better school of desire in my view than this, the Christian spiritual life, right? And within the church, I think of it as truly a school of desire, in its historical aspects and in the sacramental life, and realizing or viewing sort of my journey as a journey of desire. You know, I want things today that are very different than what I wanted when I was a young, you know, 25-year-old entrepreneur. Today, you know, I have what I refer to in the book as I've discovered some thick desires as opposed to thin, mimetic desires. And these thick desires involve my family, you know, and relationships with my friends. And my wife and I have our first baby on the way. And I have this thick desire to be a father that I'm experiencing for the first time that I didn't even know that I had inside of me and how strong it was, right? Very beautiful one. So these new desires are being unearthed right now. And I find myself in this beautiful journey of desire, where I'm constantly realizing the depth of some of my desires, specifically around family life right now. But I mean, I think all of our lives are kind of that journey.
So yeah, it's brilliant. It's very interesting. So there is quality, to desire. Some you describe some as thick and some as thin. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think it's, incorrect to say some desires are better than other desires. Some desires are very high quality desires, and some desires are very low quality desires. And where would you put our culture at the moment on, you know, if you lump all of our desires together, all our wanting together, are we operating from a fairly low quality desire? And how do you see that as impacting us?
It seems to me that our culture is full of very thin desires. And I would agree with you that their desires have various qualities, and not all desires are the same. And I think that's part of the message that our culture is sending, is that all desires are the same. Whatever you want, if you want it, go for it. That's not the way that I want to raise my children. You know, there's a hierarchy of desires. You know, I often tell I tell the story of a friend that I had who I lived in Vegas for several years. And I had at one point, right around the time I was beginning to take my faith seriously, I had a friend who decided to throw a bachelor party in Vegas. And he scheduled it for whatever reason, it happened to be Good Friday. And so what do? I have a desire to be a good friend and to be there for my friend. And he wasn't going to do anything crazy. But, you know, I that's a desire that I have, to be a good friend, a loyal friend who's there and celebrates these beautiful moments of engagement and marriage. And then I have, desire. This is the most solemn day of the year for me, right? And if I didn't have a hierarchy of desire, if one of those desires wasn't more important, if there wasn't some kind of objective criteria by which to evaluate these two desires, I could be totally, you know, torn apart by that decision. I chose to we hung out at another time, right? Didn't make the bachelor party in Vegas. I chose to do the Triduum, you know, with my family. So there is, I think, a hierarchy of desires. We have to sort of step back and see, you know, when are we being dominated by things that ultimately we'll look back on a month or a year from now and think we're silly? These things that we pursue so strongly, some short-term financial things, our pride and our envy often is fueling desires. For there's nothing there at the end. There's nothing real there at the end. Where there's other desires, for holiness, for deep, nourishing, rich relationships, desires to help people that are suffering, to be there by people that need us. Those are thicker desires. And it seems to me that the culture is sort of a runaway train of many very thin desires. And we just need more and more of them. You know, there's nothing, it's kind of like eating fast food, nothing kind of sticks. And that does concern me. does concern me when and I think social media has played a very big role in that process. And at some point, I do think we're going to need to come back to models of desire that stand the test of time, right? You know, the saints would be a great example of that, to show here are people that have pursued desires that endured and ended up leading to a deep, enduring sense of satisfaction and fulfillment and service to others and ultimately love, because the highest expression of desire is love, right? There are selfish desires and then there's self-giving desires and the desire to give of oneself.
So you've mentioned social media a couple of times, and in the book you talk about Peter Thiel as an early investor in Facebook, and how, you know, Girard's philosophy or the idea of mimetic desire influenced him. How is mimetic desire playing out in social media from the beginning and then today?
Peter Thiel was the first investor in Facebook. I think it was 2004, if I remember correctly, when Facebook was nothing really. It was just on a few college campuses. And he, having studied under René Girard at Stanford, was very familiar with the idea of mimesis. And he saw Facebook's model being an engine of mimetic desire. You know, your friends are on it, it makes you want to be on it, and then you're talking about things that you saw on Facebook, which makes it even doubly mimetic, and it's fueled by it's fueled really by a form of imitation. And he saw that, and he bet on Facebook because as he told me in the book when I interviewed him, I bet on mimesis, right? For better or worse, I knew that this thing was going to be highly mimetic, so I bet on mimesis. And I think it's, you know, and since then, you know, we now have dozens of different forms of social media. And TikTok to me is the most interesting one because it's the most mimetic of all the platforms. It's kind of premised on, you know, you see somebody do a dance and you try to imitate it, and the music, right? You find the trending music. I mean, the whole thing is almost premised on being a good imitator in a certain sense, right? Getting on the right trends, and that's why it's so incredibly powerful, right? I mean, there's the algorithm, there's a technological component of it. But to me, that's less important than the human component of it, which is the mimesis. You know, I mean, we always just we credit the technology sometimes with why these things are so powerful. Yeah. But there's something deeply this goes to the core of how we are, which is, you know, we see these things and it holds up a mirror to ourselves and we start to relate to these things that we see. Instagram is incredibly powerful. So I don't think it's not going anywhere, but one of the things I actually teach about this as my role as a professor, and help my students try to understand their relationship with social media and with all of the millions of models of desire that they're exposed to on social media, and then begin to understand how they might be affecting them. Because it affects me in a major way. During the pandemic, I actually had a desire to buy a van and travel around the country with my wife to beautiful locations, because I had been following this hashtag van life on Instagram, where I saw these people living these glamorous lives in these really fancy, nice vans, traveling to the Grand Canyon and taking these beautiful pictures. And I said, well, I can't go into the office anyway. What if we did that? What if we got an RV, or what if we got a van? You know, and my wife just, you know, laughed and said, Luke, you're writing a book on mimetic desire, and you've just been totally hijacked by looking at this van life thing on Instagram. So it's incredibly powerful. And I do think the first step is just becoming aware of how we're affected by various models.
So you've got billions of people on these platforms and these social platforms. But if you sit them down as individuals, and certainly here in the United States, they will tell you how fiercely independent they are, how fiercely autonomous they are, how critically important their personal freedoms are. And in some ways, what we're discovering here is that they are actually slaves, and have almost no independence, unless they really decide to turn it on, in this mimetic process.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say that to them, they'd be highly offended, I think. Mm-hmm. When you deal with that, you're dealing with quite the opposite of what you've just described. Okay, you say awareness is the starting point. But I think where people are is in this great unconsciousness. How do you draw them out of that unconsciousness and into this awareness about the way that mimetic desire is impacting their everyday life?
I could tell you a very short story about a friend of mine, Nicholas Christakis, who's a professor at Yale. And he very famously, he and his wife, there was a controversy on campus that I won't get into the details. It had to do with Halloween costumes. And there was a very famous video of him where he was on campus and really confronted by a crowd of very angry students. I mean, these things were almost on the verge of getting violent. It was one of the first, I think this was 2016, if I remember correctly. And the students, you know, this kind of anger is very mimetic. You know, anger is one of those extremely mimetic emotion. Somebody else next to you is angry about something. It's almost contagious, right? So there's an element of contagion about mimesis. And being in crowds that sort of turn into mobs, it's a very dangerous place to be. Nicholas said that in that moment, he said, you know, as students were confronting me, sometimes, you know, groups of five, six, seven at a time, he goes, I would ask them, you know, well, what's your name? And he goes, I asked that question very intentionally, because when I asked them their name, it's almost as if they had to remember who they are and gain some self-possession back, right? Address them as an individual and didn't treat them as part of the crowd. And I thought, you know, that's incredibly wise thing that he did. He ended up sort of very calm. He was incredibly calm throughout this process and really diffused this and ended up having personal conversations one-on-one with the students, but started by asking them their name. I think there's something very powerful about that tactic that he used that maybe we can learn. You know, it comes down to personalizing our interactions with others, getting, you know, knowing others and being known is one of the most important, one of the thickest desires that every human being has. We want to be known. We want to know other people. We don't want to be treated like one more instantiation of a species, just somebody else in the crowd. We want to be known as I want to be known as Luke, right? I want people to know me. And you know, I think the church has to do a much better job at that. I think all of us can, we need to repersonalize our culture a bit. Social media is kind of a depersonalizing force. It sounds ironic because everybody's on social media, you know, saying what they think. But at some level, it's hard, difficult to see the person behind the profile sometimes. And I think one answer is kind of these highly incarnational encounters with people where they're known, and as they are, is I think a way to kind of pierce through some of this. And that doesn't necessarily, you know, I mean, part of what you're asking is, well, how do you get people to stop realizing that they're not these completely autonomous people? I mean, I don't have an answer for that, but I do think that I do think relationships are the answer to a lot of problems, right? Like where relationships heal, relationships help us become who we are, help us to know who we are in and through relationships. And the more personal they are, the better. And we come to an awareness of, you know, all kinds of things about ourselves, including our own mimesis, I think, in relationships.
Okay, so let me ask this, because as I was reading the book, probably more the second time than the first time, you know, one of the questions I was really grappling with is, are what you call thin desires, thick desires, are the thinner desires more dehumanizing and the thicker desires more rehumanizing or repersonalizing, as you talk about? And are the thinner desires more crowd-like behavior and the thicker desires where we really come into our unique self? You talk about writing the book that only you can write. You know, that's not a thin thing. You don't come to that through a bunch of thin things. You come to that through some depth. You come to that through reflection and whatever else, and probably really good people around you speaking into that. But is it too simple to say that our thin desires are more crowd-like and our thick desires are really who we were created to be?
Well, I think that's a very important distinction. I do believe that thick desires are rooted in a deep kind of Christian personalism, and are deeply connected to vocation and calling, right? I mean, our thick desire is who we're called to be. That's one of our thickest desires. And I don't think it's an oversimplification, but the only caveat that I would make is that I wouldn't want somebody to think that there are thin desires and then there are thick desires, because it's not that they're not that separate, right? I mean, oftentimes they have desires evolve. You know, I love sports, and you know, there were years when I would just get together with my buddies for some beers to watch, you know, football on Sundays. Perhaps, you know, that's a thin desire, and you know, we've been doing that for a long time, and then there's some thicker desire underneath that to get to know each other better. And, you know, guys often need something to do in order to talk. And, you know, there's all kinds of things. There's all kinds of reasons. I would say that there's a bit of both in that kind of tradition that we have to get together, you know. And, you know, we can't go through life. You know, there are certain things what am I trying to say? I think that we also shouldn't take ourselves too seriously. I mean, I have some desires that are thin desires, you know, to go eat at a restaurant or something like that, you know, here in the city. And my wife and I both love food. And, you know, that's not something I'm going to feel bad about. You know, it's like, so I think just realizing, though, that there is a different quality to desires. And if we live our whole lives pursuing thin desires, that begins to be a problem. And, you know, what do we have that roots us or reminds us of the thick, those things that are enduring, that are connected to a deeper sense of calling and purpose and meaning? I do believe that thick desires are the locus of meaning and purpose, sense of fulfillment, where we kind of find ourselves, most ourselves, and can connect with others. I certainly didn't write this book based on thin desires alone. There might have been some thin desires in there, but I wouldn't have been able to do it, because it was an incredibly difficult process that took me several years. I wouldn't have been able to do it unless there was some deeper, thick desire in there, which was, you know, to give expression and to communicate some truths that I think are very important for people to understand, to make them accessible. Without that, if I was driven by thin desires, I would have given up on it, you know, halfway through. It wouldn't have been enough to sustain me.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So am I hearing you correctly in saying that thin desires can be good in and of themselves? They are certainly necessary to some extent, but if that's all your life has, then your life is going to probably be on the shallow, superficial end of the spectrum. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yes. You know, I think thin desires can, I think that's a great way to put it, Matthew. And, you know, I think we can do things like, you know, to give you an example, I could choose, you know, which parish to go to or what mass to go to based on some things that are relatively thin, you know, like the the way that their website looks or something like that, or the sort of the quality of the happy hour and the quality of the donuts, you know, after mass gets out or something like that, right? It would be kind of a thin desire, you know, guiding that decision. And, you know, I don't know, I'm human. So sometimes those things, I notice them, but that the thicker desire would be the sense of kind of community and sacramental life that I'm looking for. And some of them both come into play. But to your point, I think it would be, if I was only driven by the thin desires, then it would seem like, yeah, I'm missing out on some of the things that I should actually be concerned about and be looking for.
Yeah. So the other thing I was thinking about when I was reading was that, like, what limits our ability to harness this wisdom and really deploy it in practical ways in our lives. And one of the things I came down to was what I think is a poverty in our culture today is that people lack a poverty they lack a philosophy of life. So when they're trying to make a decision, that they're trying to build a philosophy from the ground up, that they're not calling on a philosophy to make that or help them make that decision. And, you know, if we look at, let's say, philosophy in ancient Greece and sort of these different schools, okay, every one of those schools had a philosophy of life. You know, you might not agree with them, but they were basically saying, this is the best way to live, or this is how you live the good life. Today, we've got all these philosophy schools, but almost none of them presenting a philosophy of life and saying, this is the best way to live, or this is the way to live a good life. How important is it for people to realize, okay, in order to live this, I need a philosophy of life. I need a body of thought, a body of belief that I'm going to draw on during moments of decision in my life so that I can escape the thinner forms of mimetic desire when I need to or want to.
It's absolutely critical. You know, we can't evaluate decisions or desires one by one without some broader framework, some teleology, you know, to use a philosophical word, right, with some end in mind, right? It does require a framework to operate in. You call it a mental model, worldview, a philosophy of life is essential. I mean, I think many people are finding that in Stoicism right now. It's got some kind of mimetic popularity in the last 15 years because it does provide that. It provides some stability, some framework. You know, it's got some complexity to it, but it's more of an overarching worldview of life. And fact is, everybody has some kind of a worldview. Just some people just don't know it, you know. But there are sort of almost metaphysical assumptions that we have to make. You know, so imagine somebody, for instance, that, you know, is struggling to change, but they don't believe that they have any free will. They don't believe in free will. You know, they think everything's deterministic. Well, if you start with that assumption, it's very difficult to have much hope, right, that you're going to be able to do anything at all, right? So somehow, kind of like our starting assumptions, the framework, the way that we view the world is critical for everything, including even how we think about this whole, you know, idea of mimetic desire. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel with some of this stuff. We don't have to build everything from the ground up. We don't have to build the plane as we're trying to fly it. We've got thousands of years of tradition that we can draw on. Some people have thought about the discernment of desire for a very long time. Ignatius of Loyola comes immediately to mind. There's this rich wisdom to draw on. And I would recommend, you know, I don't think there's anything, nothing in my book is really new. I'm trying to synthesize, you know, what I think is pretty ancient wisdom here.
So you say that we can't evaluate desires, you know, one by one. And I agree with that. But I also think a lot of people, that's how they're trying to live their lives. And it is exhausting. And by the time they come to make the bigger decisions, They're just exhausted or they're paralyzed. Do you see that taking place? And I guess, how would you encourage someone to step out of that?
I think the reason that they're paralyzed is there's a lack of continuity. And continuity brings stability and a more stable sense of self. And otherwise it just kind of feels like, you know, we're being tossed about on the waves of liquid modernity. And I think finding some stability is really important, right? And that people can find that in various ways, through place, through some stability of you know, family and friends. And virtues are almost by definition, there's stability in them, right? That's what they are. They're like a habit. And I think without those things, without some kind of stability or state on which to stand, to be able to even evaluate these things, becomes extraordinarily, difficult. I mean, it's like, there's some sense in which groundedness is important. And when I see students entering college, that where they've never sort of had the opportunity to sort of form any kind of stable habits or virtues whatsoever, and they're trying to figure it all out in their freshman year, it's extraordinarily difficult to do that. So there's something really important about sort of formation, and at a young age. I think it's much more difficult as we get to be adults, but there's something really important about forming some kind of stable base, because if our lives are built completely on thin desires because we've been scrolling social media, you know, since the time we were seven, it just makes the discernment process extraordinarily difficult. And I think there are ways out of that kind of process, but the longer we go, the harder it is to kind of find the, you know, thickness is kind of a metaphor for stability, you know?
Yeah. So let me go out on a limb here, a little bit away from the book, and we'll return to that. But Girard spent hundreds of thousands of hours thinking about this, writing about this, studying this. You've spent thousands of hours thinking about this, writing about this, teaching about this, studying this. And we're talking about one concept, okay? And when you talk about the stability that you just described, to my thinking, religion used to provide that stability. It used to provide that starting point. It used to provide that philosophy of life. And our culture has, you know, rejected religion en masse. And as a result, thrown out that stability, and everyone's left to build a philosophy of life for themselves, which, good luck. But I guess the other thing that makes me wonder is, how has mimetic desire played into the rejection of religion in our culture over the last 50, 100 years?
One way to think about, I think, the secular culture and the developments are that, in a sense, it's trying to be more Christian than Christianity, in a sense. I mean, this is something that Girard said, right? So, like, you know, a lot of the core ideas that came from Christianity, you know, the culture sort of took them and said, well, you know, we can do these things even better than the church can while simultaneously rejecting it. So there's almost an aspect of mimetic rivalry between the culture and the church, right? I mean, this is a little complex. There's a lot that I could say about it, but I think that there is kind of, along with the rejection, there's kind of a, you know, we can do a better job of protecting victims or something like that. So there's that aspect. I mean, of course, there's the on a basic level. You know, you grow up in a family that has completely rejected religion already. I mean, it just becomes that much. It just becomes very easy to follow the default mode. You know, so that there's this kind of generational, you know, mimesis thing going on too that just perpetuates the direction that we're already going in. And there's probably a third level of it too, and you know, that is, it's, you know, ideas sometimes are like fashion, and they can come in fashion and they can go out of fashion. And you know, it's not really, or it hasn't been, well, in some little pockets it's becoming not as taboo to be somebody that, you know, takes their faith seriously. And it takes courage to do that. And I think there's something anti-mimetic about, you know, speaking about, you know, your religion in public. You know, I've done a lot of podcasts, and many of them are not with Christians. And there is, I always sort of feel this, you know, tension, like, do they want to talk about this or do they not want to talk about it? Because, you know, religion is a real, you know, my Catholicism is the most important part of my life. It does provide exactly what you described for me, right? It provides this stable foundation, right? This worldview, this place where I can stand. You know, Pope Benedict uses a beautiful phrase. He said, part of the word understand is to stand, you know, and you have to be standing somewhere in order to understand. And it's where I stand. And it even helps me navigate the world of desire, you know, a lot better. So, you know, I think that there is some anti-mimetic act that's involved in being able to boldly, you know, say, this is who I am. And not a lot of people, I just know so many people that are hidden, that where their faith actually is important to them, but they feel like they have to, you know, they're like secret agents out there or something like that. You know, I know they're in Google. I know many of these people, and I wonder, like, well, how different would those cultures be if those people were more visible and they didn't feel like they needed to be underground? So there's a mimetic cut on that too.
I've recommended the book to many, many people, and I've given the book to a bunch of people. And one of the most common things people have come back to me and said is, like, I consider myself a fairly educated person. Why didn't I know about mimetic desire? Or why doesn't everybody know about mimetic desire? What would be your response to that?
One reason for that is that Gerard was a Catholic in academia. And that did not go very well for him. You know, he was totally rejected by even his own universities in some cases. I've a good friend of mine went through the genesis of his ideas were in literature. Actually, he read Shakespeare and great books and saw that much of the greatest literature in the Western world involves characters that are very realistically mimetic. And you know, he one of his books is all about novels and literature, and I've had friends that have went through entire literature programs at very good universities that learn about Gerard, and they say, how in the world did I go through 4 years of this and his name never came up? Because he's very well known for literature criticism. And I would say, well, it's because he was kind of blacklisted in academia, right? And luckily he just found this pocket of people that his reputation grew outside of the academy. Thank God. And, you know, I've had some small part to play in hopefully helping some other people become aware of him. So I think it's that. I think there was that personal factor. I think it was incredibly dense and sort of difficult to read. And third, there are, I think, some self-defense mechanisms that go up that sort of prevent some people from exploring it further. So for all these reasons, I think there were some brakes that were put on this, on the spread of the thought. I do think now, you know, Bishop Barron said, you know, I think René Girard is, you know, going to be seen as some kind of a modern father of the church. And I agree with that, obviously. I mean, I think he's incredibly important, but he also wasn't, he didn't necessarily connect his ideas to practical everyday things as probably as well as he could have. I mean, he was an academic. So I'm excited to see what happens as the ideas kind of disseminate to different people with different perspectives inside and outside of the church, and to see how the ideas evolve. And if this was a baseball game, I think like Gerard's ideas were in the second inning, maybe, at like understanding what they mean in various contexts.
And if that was in the second innings, where are we in the baseball game?
I think we're probably in the second inning.
Okay. All right.
Gerard was very apocalyptic, so he might say that we're in the ninth inning, but I'm not quite that pessimistic.
Yeah, okay. Maybe depends on what we define the ninth inning as, but to write something this good, to write something I think this important, requires obsession. And I use that word in a really healthy way. I think that there are really healthy obsessions. I think we're actually, as human beings, we're created for obsession, and ultimately obsession with goodness, with virtue, with character, and then ultimately with God. But, you know, in going into this and becoming obsessed with this in a healthy way, how has that driven the people close to you crazy? You know, whether that's your wife or your close friends, what is that dynamic like?
That's really funny. My wife, she's seen more of it than anybody. Poor Claire, she's heard the word mimesis and mimetic more than any human should have to in their lifetime as I was writing this book. And she was an incredible interlocutor for me as I was writing it. Incredible. It wouldn't be the book it is without her. But she actually said just the other day, she goes, Luke, I liked it when you were writing a book. When are you going to write another book? You're driving me crazy now because you don't have something to be that obsessed with. Can you find something else to write about? So I'm working on it. So it was actually the opposite. I think one of the things that made this book fun and drove her a little less, and my friends a little less crazy, was that, you know, we would always find, because it's of this pervasive nature of the idea, right? It's just, you can see it absolutely everywhere. And it was just so fun because you know how sometimes like once you know about something, you start seeing it everywhere. It's even absolutely. Like once you have a car, you start seeing the car on the road all over the place. And this idea is a bit like that. You know, so, you know, we would see mimetic behavior on television or, you know, in the news. And I get text messages from my friends, Luke, aren't you writing a book about this? So it made it fun. I am the kind of person who just really becomes consumed with one thing until I've properly expressed it. And hopefully I can sense that might be happening again, but I think I'm probably driving my wife crazier now that I don't have that.
Very good. You talk about the universality of the concept, and I'd like to just take a look at a handful of different areas of life and ask you to comment on how mimetic desire affects the way we participate in these areas of life. So let's say in the area of career, how is mimetic desire at play in the way we choose a career, the way we participate in a career, or how does it affect us, you know, as a career unfolds?
Well, I believe in a certain amount of path dependency when it comes to careers. And, you know, in my case, I went to a business school kind of randomly. I mean, I initially wanted to be a doctor because I watched a lot of ER when I was a kid with my mom, and I thought George Clooney was really cool. So I applied to pre-med for purely mimetic reasons. And I didn't get in anywhere that I applied to for pre-med. So I said, I'll just go into business school and I'll like start a hospital or something like that. And that was about as deep as my reasoning went, honestly. And when I got there, Everybody at the school wanted to work on Wall Street. Now, the thought of working on Wall Street never crossed my mind before I got there. And I just sort of got, well, that if there everybody wants to do that, then that must be valuable, right? This must be, and I just sort of went, and I went that track. And also, there's a funny thing about human nature, some people more than others. It's the case with me, where if you tell me that something is hard, that it's very difficult to do, I'm instantly attracted to it, right? Oh, it's hard to get a job at Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley. Great, then I'm going to do it. And it could be all the wrong reasons, right? But it just, I'm attracted to it simply because of that, even if it's completely not aligned with my personality or with what I even want to do or where I find enjoyment. It's funny. Sometimes we're good at things that make us miserable. I was good at math. So it's like, well, if you're good at math, Luke, therefore you would really like working on Wall Street. Not true. So you know, I follow this hypermimetic track. And then, you know, once there, you know, it's just very, can be difficult to get off of these mimetic tracks. And, I think, because in a career, in a more traditional career, a company, there's always some step higher you can go, usually, unless you're the CEO. And that always provides fuel for some new form of mimetic desire, right? Well, oh, I'm not entirely happy now, but if I just get to vice president, then I'll have more free time. And it never quite works out the way that you think, you know, it just never does. Because there's always models that are a little bit above you. And I think just being aware of this power of mimetic desire, this force can help people understand when they might be driven to pursue a position within their company or a career change, for maybe not for the best reasons. And just to add a new layer of awareness to this. And one of the reasons, by the way, that a lot of company leaders get very nervous when, a key person leaves the company is because the person becomes a model for other people to leave the company, right? So this plays out in all kinds of ways with careers, some positive and some negative, right? I think there are probably more negative ones, but I mean, I think of positive things. I mean, if a young man doesn't have a good model of desire for considering the priesthood, you know, maybe he just never will. Right. You know, we need positive models of desire in situations like that. Not to call that a career, but we're sort of just talking about paths and vocations here. So I think just understanding, well, where are the good, virtuous models and people who want things that seem more aligned with my thick desires? And where am I becoming like obsessively focused on people or things that maybe for reasons that are more aligned within desires.
Okay, so career vocation, obviously a very serious thing. And, you know, I think you provide some very practical insights into that. Take something, you know, much less serious. And let's say, I think you talk about in the book a little bit, like where we go on vacation or vacation destinations. How does mimesis impact where we go on vacation?
I mean, very often, you know, where do we get the idea to go on vacation to a certain place in the first place? You know, so there's an algorithmic angle here where, you know, I Google, I'm really tired and I just feel like laying on a beach for a week. So I go on my computer and I Google, you know, most affordable beach vacations with direct flights from DC or something like that. And I'm presented with, I live in Washington, DC, most of the year at least. And I'm presented with 10 options. There's a very good chance that I'm going to pick one of those 10 options. Now, you know, I don't even know what's out there. I might never even look at it. And there's more than, you know, probably 10 good options in the world. So in a sense, I'm very, you know, confined to those. And in a sense, those options are presented to me in the first place, largely because of mimesis. You know, they're ranked that way because other people have went there. So, you know, what's left to be undiscovered, and or also even more likely is because I'm looking on social media and seeing my friend coming back from a specific vacation. So the mimetic desire really confines my choices to those things for which I have models. Funny, a couple, and I write a newsletter called Anti-Mimetic, which is all about, like, you know, making anti-mimetic choices and thinking through how we're affected by mimesis. Two of the most wonderful vacation experiences of my life came kind of through the throwing the dart at the map kind of process, which is, you could call that the anti-mimetic sort of like way of choosing a place to go. You're like introducing some randomness into the process. I remember when I was writing the book, I actually wrote the first couple of chapters of the book in a little town in southeast France called Collioure, and nobody had ever mentioned this place to me before. I pulled up a map of, because I needed to go do an interview there. I interviewed Chef Sebastian Brault. So I just pulled up a map of France and zoomed in on Google and just looked for things that looked like really cool little towns that were near the water. And I couldn't find anybody who had ever recommended this town. And I picked it and I went. It turned out to be one of the best little trips that we've ever taken, you know? So I guess part of me wanted to kind of remove myself from the mimetic tracks to open up these new kind of ideas and wonder, and I don't know, maybe it's just me being, maybe it's just my own pride of wanting to be the first to discover a new place or something like that. But I found it tremendously satisfying to sort of choose vacations like that.
What about our culture is becoming increasingly divided and polarized? What role do you see mimesis playing in that?
No doubt about it. You know, in U.S. politics, it's happening. You know, Gerard says this very provocative thing. He says, you know, be careful who you make your enemies because you become like them. And he says that there's a direct relationship between sameness and conflict. In other words, the more that people have in common, the greater likelihood there is going to be for conflict. You know, it's no coincidence. There's stories of sibling rivalry in almost every culture in the world, right? And there's five stories of sibling rivalry in the book of Genesis alone. And, you know, Gerard says, well, maybe there's some truth there, right? Often identical twins. Maybe this, the sameness is sort of what spawns some kind of mimetic response to differentiate ourselves from other people. You know, Freud would call it the narcissism of small differences. And, you know, it's why you sort of look at, I think as a culture becomes more homogenous, partly due to things like social media, partly due to the inability to be able to say what you really think, in, you know, in universities, as everything takes on the appearance of sameness, or everybody's sort of, the expectations of everybody converge on being the right kind of person, saying the right kinds of things, kind of leveling out one's personhood and individuality, that's actually bringing us towards more conflict, if Gerard is right. You know, so it's funny, like there's more rivalry sometimes inside of the church than there is between the church and the secular culture, because more in common inside of the church. So it's more likely to fight over some very small, sometimes often insignificant thing. Believe me, I was in seminary. You know, you begin to become fixated on these small things because you have so much in common. And, you know, Gerard would say, no, that can be somewhat dangerous. So I think this goes back to something that we were talking about earlier, and it's the relationship somehow between thick desires and our kind of, we are persons who are called by name, and we do have, you know, we do have a very personal relationship, you know, with God and others. And I think there is something important about that. And to get back to allow for like this, a flourishing kind of diversity of persons and opinions and thinking and ideas, would actually do more to quell the polarization than by getting people to kind of organize into, you know, into tribes, which I understand that, because I guess there's power in numbers. But it's ultimately something Gerard is warning us against.
Mm. If someone's watching or listening and thinking, okay, this is great. How do I go from blind wanting to intentional wanting, what advice would you have for them?
Well, if they're a Christian, then, you know, certainly this is something to take into, you know, your prayer life and your spiritual life. You know, and ask, well, what is it that God wants of me? And that's and sort of beginning to sort of see the journey as a journey of desire and the alignment of desires. You know, in my marriage, you know, there's kind of my wife and I, there's this dance of desire. There's some things that we just want that are different, and there are other things that we want that are the same, and kind of how does that dance play out? It's a beautiful, exciting adventure. And then bringing a level of discernment to desires. And I think discernment is unfortunately something that everybody can learn to do. It's not something that is taught in school. I'd never heard the word discernment until I was in my mid-20s, maybe even my late-20s. And I was a poker player. I lived in Vegas and I played a lot of poker. And, you know, there's an element of intuition in poker, but you also need to sort of know, you know, your odds and when you have a good hand and when you don't. And my decision-making process for, you know, how or when to play a hand was one that didn't require discernment. It was more of a kind of a calculating decision-making process. Discernment is a bit different because, you know, choosing, you know, who to marry, career paths, all of these things are not decisions that we can make like, you know, playing a hand in poker. You know, they're decisions that require a deeper layer of discernment, and discernment often of competing desires, you know, because we have desires, simultaneous desires for two different things, and we can't, you know, can't have both sometimes, right? And discernment, and I think Ignatius is very good with this, you know, sitting with, you know, learning to, first of all, acknowledge the desires that you do have at the end of every day. It's something I've worked into my examination of conscience. Well, Luke, what did you want today? Who, you know, how were you affected, you know, on an emotional level, on a spiritual level? What do those desires mean? Kind of like taking them through this process of sitting with them, this process of discernment, rather than just taking them for granted, you know, because not all desires are created equal. Some of them, frankly, can lead us to places we won't want to go, can make us totally miserable. Some of them are easy to discern, you know, if it's sinful, then that desire is there. I have that desire. Why do I have that desire? You know, there are other desires, you know, for holiness, for virtue, for nourishing relationships, and learning to sit with them and to understand where they came from and where they're going and how to, whether to feed them, in the case of the bad ones, right? Whether to, I'll just use the word starve them or what to do with those. That's an incredibly important skill to learn. And, you know, it can be taught in families. It can be, but it's probably not going to happen in school unless you go to a very good one. And it requires a formation of, and frankly, the acquisition of some wisdom and worldview, like you said, that helps us understand where these desires ultimately lead us. And we have to have the worldview. We kind of have to have an end in mind in order to be able to make sense of any of this stuff in the moment, or else we're just kind of going from one to the next.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, either out of immaturity or out of, you know, what I would say maybe broken philosophies or incomplete philosophies, fall into a binary stance of desires are good or bad. And of course, we see the extreme of that in some philosophies and religions where they essentially say, you know, you should kill your desire. You know, your desires are bad for you and you need to liberate yourself from desire completely. How would you respond to that?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very important point to make. And in our desires, even when they're, let's say, sinful, there's something important to learn from them. Oftentimes it's the case of not allowing that desire to go far enough, right? I'm thinking of pornography, things like this. What is it really a desire for? You know, is it a desire for intimacy? Oftentimes, there's our desires are not, we don't live in this sort of Manichaean world where desires are either good or bad. They're always telling us something or pointing us towards something. They're real. They say something about where we're at. But we are not our desires too. And this is an important thing to understand. Like, I am not just my desires. And I think that's an important thing to understand. I mean, I want a lot of things. We're all kind of mixtures of a bunch of different desires, some thin, some thick. And we're complex creatures. And there's some of our desires are very mysterious, and we don't have to have them all figured out. But seeing them as part of a relationship with God, drawing us onwards, drawing us towards something, we do have to interpret them. We have to make sense of them. We have to understand who they're coming from. Some don't come from God. Some don't come from good sources. And this is Ignatius 101, right? The discernment of spirits, right? Good spirits, evil spirits. So, but usually it's much more complex. And I would say that the lesson is to really learn to be with our desires more before just reacting. You know, like oftentimes we just want to react right away. We have this desire. There's a lot of ways to deal with a desire or to forget that we have it, right? A lot of very unhealthy ways that can lead to addictions. So part of it's very difficult sometimes just go outside and take a walk for 20 minutes and just sit with our desires or with our emotions. But oftentimes it's one of the healthiest things that we can do is just sit with them rather than trying to distract ourselves and move on to the next thing.
You mentioned Shakespeare earlier, and you speak about him in the book. You also mentioned earlier when we were talking about your book, about your editor mentioning that a lot of books, they have a life of 4 or 6 weeks and they do something or they don't, but then, you know, the culture moves on. The longevity of Shakespeare and the persistent relevance of his work, you link to his understanding of mimetic desire. How conscious do you think he was of that, or how intuitive was it, an intuition, or how would you talk about that?
Yeah, Gerard says that Shakespeare was one of the writers who seemed to understand the nature of the human person better than any other writer, and that's why his work is so powerful. And it's unlikely that Shakespeare would have put it in these terms and said all my characters are mimetic and are influenced by, you know, the desires of other characters and enter into rivalries with them because of that desire. But he clearly had an intuition. I think that's what Gerard would say, right? He just had a deep understanding of human nature. That's why his characters are so real. Mimetic desire can be very funny. I mean, that's why some of Shakespeare's comedies, you know, you've got these, you know, two guys chasing the same woman and they reinforce the desire for that woman. And if one walks away, the other one loses the desire, and then the other one comes back and the other one gains the desire. So comedies and tragedies, you've got in Othello, Iago is a mediator of desire to every character in that play. He is pulling the strings of what everybody else wants in some sense. There's not a single play that Shakespeare wrote where you will not see mimesis. Now that you know about it, now that you've listened to this, or if you've read the book, you'll see it all over the place in Shakespeare. And I just think he was a genius of human nature, kind of like Gerard was. And that's what makes those plays so absolutely enduring. Whereas Gerard contrasted Shakespeare to other novels where, you know, characters just, all their desires seem to be completely spontaneous and there's no explanation of where they came from. And it's like the other characters in the play don't influence them at all. And Gerard would say, those typically don't end up being classic novels because they're not real. You know, they don't actually account for the role of mimesis in human relationships.
That's fantastic. The book has been out for almost a year now, and it has been beautifully successful. And I say beautifully successful because I love when things that are really, really good for people are successful. And as you look back on it now, are there things that you think, oh, I wish I would have put that in the book, or I wish I would have included this story or example or quote, or is there anything like that?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I already went a bit longer probably than my editor would have wanted me to. So I don't know about additions. I think the right things are in the book. You know, some of the things that I think are really, really important in the book, like the role of mimesis in conflict and violence and scapegoating, that kind of negative form of mimesis that leads people and, you know, in crowds to be caught up in this contagion. That stuff doesn't come until about halfway through the book, because I wanted to start with, you know, this introduced this concept of mimetic desire, and I work up to that. And actually, I talk very specifically, you know, about the crucifixion and the Gospels, and many people who wrote this book kind of get to that chapter and are like, I wasn't expecting this, you know, because I wrote it for a broad audience. I think because it's kind of in the middle of the book, well, first of all, many people don't read entire books, and I'm aware of that as an author. You know, they'll read the first few chapters. That didn't get as much attention as I was expecting it to, and I think it's because it's just it's buried in the middle of the book. So I might have changed the order of that. I just didn't want to make it too dark, you know. And I wrote this book with the full expectation that this is one book, and that you don't need to do everything in one book, Luke. And that there's probably a second book in this where I could write a whole book on mimetic politics. You know, I could probably write a whole book on the way that this plays out in relationships, and the same thing with the spiritual theology and the way that this kind of works in the life of the church and in the life of a Christian or a Catholic. So it was an important lesson for me to learn, because my temptation as an author is always to just squeeze the maximum amount in. And I learned through the help of, I think, wise friends and my wife and my editor, you know, Luke, don't try to bite off more than you can chew. You can always write more. You can always, and that's why, you know, I write weekly. I have a newsletter, so I'm able to get some of that stuff out.
Yeah. This section on scapegoating was absolutely brilliant. And I was, as you described, I was surprised. I was surprised how little aware I was of the history of scapegoating. It was a phenomenally powerful section of the book. But let me ask you this, and I'll make this our last question. Is there value in practicing anti-mimetic exercises in our own lives? Is there value in building anti-mimetic muscles? And if there is, like, what's one way people could go about that?
I think there is value in that. There are other areas where we want to actually be more mimetic, right? When there's a positive model of desire, you know, somebody who's an extraordinarily, you know, model of who desires holiness, right? It's like, I want more of what they want. I want to be positively infected by them. So the lesson is not to go through life being, you know, this anti-mimetic, because one of the points in the book is that we're all mimetic and you actually can't totally escape it. But where do we need to be anti-mimetic? You know, what areas of life do we need to develop some of that, those capabilities, right, to withstand negative mimesis? And I think that when it comes to media consumption, comes to the way that we're influenced by the craziness of mimetic rivalry in politics, where people are just totally swept up in what are often thin desires, losing track of what's really important for these minor, you know, wins, these little victories, you know. You know, it's like winning the argument, losing the person type stuff. Like, all social media is another one where I feel personally that, you know, I've needed to and continue to need to develop some anti-mimetic machinery so that I can have self-possession when I'm not off social, I'm on very much on social media, but just to develop a healthier relationship to it. Yes. And I think it looks different for everybody. I gave 15 examples of tactics and things that I've put into practice at various points in my own life, right? Like one of those included, you know, putting up boundaries with people that I thought I cared about what they were doing too much. And I just realized that they were making me forget about, you know, what it is that what my thick desires are. There's all kinds of things, and I won't get into all of them here, but I think that the key is identifying where in our lives do we sense that we might be being affected by mimesis in a negative way. And, you know, everybody just has to answer that question for themselves. And then being intentional about understanding how it happens. You know, usually when we get caught up in behaviors that we don't want to do, there's a process that happens. And, you know, sometimes just knowing what that process looks and feels like when it starts can help us put the brakes on it before we get completely caught up in it. You know, I can tell you, right, what is it? We're having this conversation in the morning. By 5 p.m. my time, I could probably tell you whether I'm going to get up and work out in the morning based on a series of things that will start happening by about 5 o'clock, right? And I think that that's one way of kind of thinking through mimesis, not as a one-time event, not as a discrete thing, but as processes that we're involved in. And if you know how the process plays out, you're aware of it, you can actually take intentional action at the right time if you need to.
Yeah, that awareness is beautiful. I have just so enjoyed our conversation. I love the book, as I've said, can't say enough. People who want to learn more about this, learn more about you, stay in touch with you, where should they go?
Well, thanks, Matthew. I very much enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me. They can find the book pretty much anywhere, you know, books are sold. And I'm pretty easy to find, lukeburgess.com. And I write regularly at read.lukeburgess.com. I've got a Substack newsletter that I publish pretty much weekly.
Fantastic. The book is Wanting. Our guest, Luke Burgess, fantastic being with you. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Thanks, Matthew. You too.
Take care now.